Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of IB Green Minds. I am delighted to present our guest this week, Jason Mitchell, who's co-head of responsible investment at Man Group and the presenter of the Sustainable Future podcast. It's a true honor to have with us such a legend of the podcasting world today.
You're too kind. Thanks, Nicholas. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to our conversation and congrats on graduating and hosting a number of great episodes on this.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jason. To begin today, from your experience, when people talk about investing responsibly, what is it that they are actually trying to achieve?
That's sort of a big question, and there are a lot of different things they can achieve. Responsible investment is, a very useful umbrella term that kind of captures the three dominant approaches, I would say, and I would say that the GSIA, the Global Sustainable Investments Alliance, reinforce this. But within that umbrella, you have traditionally exclusions-oriented negative screening type strategies. You've got ESG strategies, which are about measuring ESG, environmental, social, and governance factors, and using that to invest in different ways and engage with companies. And then the third is, I would say, impact, which is about intentionality and additionality. And those are two areas that you sometimes find within the ESG space, but not always. And I guess I would highlight that you find many strategies, investment strategies out there where there's a lot of overlap between these three categories. So I would highlight that they're not competing approaches. More often than not, you're finding increasingly a mix of different approaches.
And you've actually been involved in the CFA certificate in ESG investing. Could you tell us a bit more about this and what your contribution has been to this?
Yeah, sure. So one of my, and in fact, actually, this is probably the genesis for the my own podcast. It was sort of upon reflection, having been in the sustainable investment finance space for about 12 years, with the UK government and in the past decade with Man Group or parts of Man Group. I think I've always been a bit perplexed why finance hasn't done a better job in terms of education within this space, particularly from a podcast perspective. There are so many, actually some very good podcasts out there, but they tend to be platforms for products, for strategies, for portfolio managers and strategists reading from a compliance checked script. And as a result, they tend to sort of be less additive to kind of the general conversation. And so I think that education is absolutely key. And it's fascinating. This area sort of lends itself to that because it touches so many different sectors, tools and approaches, from discretionary to quant, to active to passive, more rigid quant-oriented systematic strategies to more sort of softer engagement-led strategies. I think the industry has been waiting for is better education in a more formalized setting. And I think it's fantastic that the CFA has done that. So the CFA UK has launched the Investing in ESG certificate that happened last year. And they've now launched edition 2 of it past the pilot. So I've contributed to chapter 8, which is on integrating ESG in portfolio construction and management. So it's a roughly about an 80-page chapter, and it goes through the spectrum, makes at least an attempt to, again, from passive to active across all asset classes, from discretionary to quant. One thing that I would point out, because I personally, having come up through the discretionary side of investing, i.e. the kind of bottom-up fundamental side of investing, both in the alternative space and long-only space over my career. I've sort of followed this in one direct way, but this chapter and the book itself was sort of a great opportunity to first sort of see the progress of ESG investing, but to also sort of pick out areas where, you know, we need a lot more attention. One thing that I've sort of found is that when you look at many case studies out there, and there are many, they tend to be issuer or security oriented. They tend to be very specific. I myself have written a number of these. But as you elevate your understanding of ESG or impact to higher levels, i.e. to portfolio management, to manager selections for consultants or fund of funds, or ultimately to the strategic or to some degree dynamic asset allocation level, those tools, those approaches, that degree of integration becomes more and more rarefied, which I found really interesting. The chapter was a great opportunity to highlight some of the progress that not just academics, but practitioners across the gamut, from asset owners to consultants to other asset managers and third-party data providers, to show what people have contributed to this space and how much it's advanced. And frankly, Nicholas, I mean, upon reflection, it's incredible how fast this space is evolving. I turned in the final draft in January.
Right.
Of this year, and that doesn't really capture a lot of the regulatory change, you know, particularly within the EU that's happened, and what that, you know, and the implications that will carry for portfolio management and construction. So there's a lot more room and a lot of change even over the past, you know, 8 to 9 months still that needs to be reflected in the next edition.
And one of the things you mentioned was the, you know, this difference between the bottom-up versus top-down approaches. Could you maybe, you know, describe what these differences are, what's involved in these two different approaches?
I actually find it probably the most interesting thing to reconcile within the space, which is to say that over the past 1 to 2 decades, ESG is generally been defined as fundamental and bottom up, and typically implemented by portfolio managers or investment teams, not quants, not machines, and people, teams, they're looking for specific things. They meet with companies. They're trying to pick apart, you know, the company strategy. There's a specific process, you know, in terms of implementing ESG within the investment process. And typically that means defining your universe in some sort of boundary using a number of different ESG data providers. That could vary widely. And obviously meeting with the company and trying to understand, I guess I could only call, I guess I'd call it sort of this state of equilibrium, this behavioral equilibrium. How does a company act or behave when it comes to ESG factors, and what does that say about the past, its past history, and what does that say about the future, and particularly about sort of the risk that it poses to the company. And typically during this process, there'll be this iterative kind of process of engagement with the investment teams and managers have with companies. And I think that process is fascinating, but what's the output of it? It tends to be very anecdotal. It tends to be very specific. It tends to be very case study oriented, and case studies are incredibly important. I'm not demeaning them, but I'd say that, you know, generally when you kind of outline or sketch a case study, it tends to be cherry picked. It tends to sort of be you're constructing a picture. It's constructivist in a sense. The point I'm trying to say is this: it tends to be very heavy on story and anecdote. Now, the top-down approach, the quant approach, is almost completely opposite, right? Quants aren't meeting with companies, or if they are, it's very rarely. They are trying to identify or understand or describe, let's call it ESG, across markets, across sectors, across regions, or asset classes, and without the luxury of understanding the bottom-up specific story. And these can seem almost you know, entirely opposing or contradictory. You know, in a sense, I don't know if I did my master's in political economy and international relations, and I tend to think of, you know, in that space, you have rational choice theory versus something called social constructivism. And the rational choice theory is about a generalizable kind of rule or understanding of the world, and social constructivism tends to be this sort of equivalent of this bottom-up kind of understanding of specific anecdotes or stories or exceptions or anomalies, and trying to sort of explain them away. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, I actually think that what I'm describing is for, I think, many multi-strat asset managers is sort of a problem, and this includes Man Group, or sort of an interesting problem of when you think of these approaches, think of sort of this intersection of top-down versus bottom-up driving sometimes differing or even opposing expectations or approaches or needs or use cases for what ESG is. And I think that intersection creates this very lively, just fascinating debate about sort of, I guess you could call it the etiological kind of understanding of what ESG is, right? What is it, and what are you solving for, and how can it be best used? But, you know, I'd say at Man Group, so we have these two opposing expectations or approaches to ESG, just as I assume, again, many other multi-strat asset managers have. And so one of my jobs is to try and sort of reconcile this and to understand how can we best use this. You know, generally, I think what we have concentrated on is trying to use the tools and developments on each side, and particularly some of the kind of new interesting tools on the quant side, to reinforce, you know, these sort of, I think, incredibly important questions. You know, can you empirically show the informational value of ESG? In order to do that, you've got to define it in a very specific way, i.e. in an uncorrelated or an orthogonal way. And I say that because ESG, one of, I think, the problems with ESG, and it might be one of the reasons that quantitative finance looks at sort of the world of sustainable investing, ESG, a little bit skeptically, is that when you think of ESG and you do sort of a factor exposure of it, in most cases, if not all, you find, and this includes other managers that I've seen, some asset owners, and particularly third-party data providers, what these are describing as ESG are often an amalgam, sort of a sloppy mess of other factors. You know, it tends to be large companies. It tends to be quality. So certain companies that have characteristics that are quality-oriented. And when I say quality, I don't mean that in a qualitative sense. I mean that in sort of a quant finance sense, quality companies have certain attributes. You know, they have high returns, strong cash flow. They tend to be more mature. But the point I'm making is that as you start to describe ESG according to these other qualities, you run into this sort of circular problem of, what is ESG? Is it just an amalgam of other factors, or is it something unique and specific? You know, I was at a conference once, and I heard, this is last year, and I heard someone from the crowd say, ESG is the new quality. That's cute. I mean, it might be glib, but it's wrong. I mean, frankly, and it actually, I think, doesn't recognize the immense work often by academics and sort of underpinned by many economic cycles of empirical research used to kind of define these factors, i.e. like Fama French factors. Mm-hmm. Right. So I've gone off on a string, but does that make sense a little bit?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think you covered a point which I'm very interested in, which is the importance of untangling the different factors which make up ESG as well.
Yeah. material. Yeah, because I think, and to go on a little bit, if you don't mind, I think it's really important right now because, you know, we've obviously seen through this year and actually certainly beginning last year, strong asset flows into this space. And now there have been a great many claims that ESG has outperformed the markets or done quite well through the pandemic. And I'm not saying it hasn't. I just think that we need to be a bit more rigorous in terms of how, what we're calling ESG. You know, the fact is growth funds have actually outperformed significantly through this pandemic. Many ESG funds have growth within that. So are we calling sort of, you know, growth the new ESG? That doesn't make a lot of sense, frankly. There can be certain endemic qualities within ESG, but I think we need to sort of unpick a bit more some of the factors contributing to performance rather than sort of very abstractly calling it that, particularly given the fact that, as we all know, there's a high disagreement among managers, among third-party data providers, among data sets about what exactly we're trying to measure, you know, in the first case.
Yeah. So I think that that covers the point I wanted to discuss, which is this idea of ESG being a source of alpha advantage. I guess that depends, as you say, very much on a case by case and materiality of the company being assessed. Is that what you?
Yeah, well, look, if you're an asset owner or consultant and you've invested, as an example, into a manager who, let's say, as a thought experiment, manages a large cap Japanese value fund, you will meet that investment team and that portfolio manager several times throughout the year to review their performance. And you will speak in a general framing of Japan large cap and value. And then you'll talk about stock attribution and sort of story and then kind of go on from there about what's changed within the portfolio. But that framing is incredibly important, right? If you, as that allocator, visit that team, you know, in another 12 months, and instead of Japan large cap value, you find the portfolio full of small cap US growth names, there's going to be a problem. You didn't allocate to that type of factor or strategy, and likely you will redeem. They haven't followed their mandate. And I guess my point is, how do you have that kind of constructive ongoing conversation when it comes to the ESG world? Because, you know, typically if you're a fundamental kind of discretionary manager, you've got performance attribution and a risk sheet. Typically it's called Brinson attribution, and it will break down your returns by a number of different factors, but typically it tends to be region, sector, stock specific, and there could be other ones, but there isn't a specific one for ESG. When you look at other factors like value or growth, et cetera. And so, you know, if someone is saying that, sure, ESG is driving a lot of my alpha in my fund, well, look, let's work on explicating this. I mean, how, you know, in terms of performance attribution, how much performance has it driven, you know, over the past 12 months or 3 years or whatever? Can you speak in a performance attribution sort of language? And there are a lot of nuances and difficulties in doing this. I'm not saying it's easy by any means, but you've got to have that conversation to be able to make a claim to say there is ESG alpha in my strategy. If you can't point to attribution, how can you make a strong claim around alpha? And this attribution issue, it tends to be what quants are very, very good at. And so that's one of the research projects that we've been sort of working off over the last couple of years. And again, by no means is it easy. I think what you're starting to see is some evolution in terms of reporting performance. In the CFA chapter, sort of I highlighted Style Analytics, which uses Style Analytics has been around for about 10, 20 years, but they have a very good kind of skyline picture of what your fundamental kind of factor risk is for any portfolio. They've now included an ESG factor, but the reality is that ESG factor isn't sort of a standalone factor. They draw it from Sustainalytics, and that's just an amalgam of a lot of other factors. So I might sound critical, but I think it's important to say that people are starting to kind of recognize the problem and kind of work towards solving it. But it's a very quantitative issue in terms of kind of solving it.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's come up a few times in episodes I've recorded over the last year, and exactly that question about attribution. So I think it's something to look forward to over the coming months. And I was wondering for yourself, maybe the last 12 months or so since I myself started presenting this podcast and now sadly have to hand it over to the next generation of master students, are there any kind of main themes that you'd pick out from the last 12 months or most significant trends?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, there are probably more over the last 12 to 18 months than I can think of in any sort of single kind of similar period over the past 5 to 10 years, frankly. I mean, first is, I know many other guests, and I won't go on too much into it, but I mean, regulation is a huge and ongoing theme, and it's evolving sometimes in friendly and sometimes in less friendly ways. And I mean less friendly specifically because you've seen almost the now a collision course sort of set up between the EU and their efforts around SFDR, the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation, and what the US is doing with under the Department of Labor, which through two proposed rulings limiting corporate pension and 401k plans, you know, effectively would works to undermine the materiality and sort of relevance of sustainability factors or ESG factors, as sort of material to the economic interests of the underlying investors. So that will be interesting to see how it plays out over, you know, the fourth quarter. I mean, those rulings are coming out, I think, sometime in October. So regulation is a key issue. One thing I would add, because I'm on EFRAG, which is the European Financial Reporting Advisory Group, and that's a European Commission supported group that does work streams around financial and non-financial reporting issues and makes recommendations to the European Council Commission. The one thing I think is just absolutely fascinating right now and clearly much needed, given the high degree of disagreement when it comes to ESG standards, is the EFRAG work around NFRD. There, it sounds like there are too many acronyms in this podcast, but the Non-Financial Reporting Directive. And that's to say that the European Commission now sees an opportunity or, in fact, a need, given other regulatory efforts, to create sort of a baseline non-financial reporting standard, an ESG standard in a sense. And so that, I think, is going to be incredibly exciting and clearly divisive, but that's something to look forward to. Other themes that I would say, stewardship, obviously has always been a theme, but it's been interesting to see how it's evolved. I would say that earlier this year, and this began with work that started in the fall of last year, we saw a couple incredibly important precedents around climate shareholder proposals, one with Barclays and another one in Japan for the first time ever against Mizuho Bank. So I think this will carry on in terms of more heavy-handed shareholder proposal efforts to, in the case of Barclays, force or push management to at least reply or respond with their own proposals. It'll also be interesting to see, particularly having gone through the pandemic and the myriad kind of social issues, particularly around inequality and race with Black Lives Matter, to see how what that does to the next AGM season coming up, if we see other you know, proposals that are more S related around that, and particularly around biodiversity. There's been some interesting research coming on recently. I would also say from a research perspective, it's been interesting, I think, in two areas. One, I have to give credit to the PRI, the Principles for Responsible Investment, for putting out some very provocative work, particularly around the IPR, the Inevitable Policy Response, which, you know, sort of makes case for climate risk going unabated to the point where we see knee-jerk reactions from governments in some form of policy, either a carbon tax or potentially a national carbon market in the U.S., but that policy response having big implications in terms of repricing, particularly carbon-intensive assets. So I think more research like that has been a really important theme, as well as research that, going back to the first part of this conversation, that pushes up ESG integration from the issuer level up to the asset allocation level. TCFD to some degree does that as well, pushing it up to the portfolio level. But I think that we're starting to see more and more a combination of academics and practitioners talk about how climate risk needs to be formally introduced into asset allocation models. Currently, it's not. Yeah, I would highlight those themes.
And I think that ties in nicely into the question that I always end my shows on, which is on a slightly more maybe high level. Imagine we're in 2049, 1 year away from having to reach net zero. What would you see the world as looking like?
You know, I'm not a pessimist. I'm more of a realist, but I do think that sustainability is going to shape all facets of our life going forward in sometimes in very disruptive ways. I go back, and for anyone who hasn't read the book, I highly recommend it. It's David Wallace Wells, The Uninhabitable Earth. And I think there are a few things that he talks about inside that book and then outside. And I do think that, you know, the idea of the three S's, speed, scope, and scale, are going to catch us wrong-footed. We're starting to see that in some areas. I mean, particularly in California. I'm from California with regard to the wildfires. But I think when I imagine a world in 2049, I think I've heard from David Wallace Wells and a few others, this idea that when we talk about regime change, for anyone that's sort of studied political science or international relations, when you recall back to the Bretton Woods institutions in post-war, you know, it was about a certain ideology around free trade, free markets, and these and cooperation, typified by multilateral institutions like the World Health Organization or the United Nations, or the World Trade Organization. And I think I find it interesting to think whether, just given the speed and scope and scale that Wells talks about, that if by 2049 there hasn't been a regime change in a different way, and rather than a focus on free trade and free markets, it's one where ecological survival is the primary focus, and it changes sort of our conceptualization of free trade and free markets and open markets, and even important norms, frighteningly, because of the sort of imperative to survive through this. I don't know if that makes sense much, but it's something that I find incredibly fascinating, and that I do work over, and that I can see certainly likely over the next 30 years.
Yeah, it's like a big paradigm shift for global society. So that's in a way daunting and in a way exciting. So look forward to. So thank you very much, Jason, for taking the time to speak to us today and share your thoughts.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Nicholas. I appreciate it.